This is Fire Through Spirit with Corby Midline. Empower Radio.
EmpowerRadio.com.
Here's your host, Corby Midline.
Hello, folks out there. I hope you survived the blood moon this week, the Hunter's Moon. We're going from full to waning now. And according to my dear buddy and your Empower Scopes person, Sherita Starr, when the moon is waning, it's a time to get rid of things we don't want. I bet you, if you've ever done anything like that, if you're female, probably on the top of the list is X pounds.
Yes.
Look, if you're not one of them, I know you know one. The person who constantly struggles with food and body issues. So after decades of looking at every possible solution and none of them working very well, I was amazed to find that yoga and its practice of mindfulness can offer a surprisingly effective path to well-being. So my guest tonight is Melissa Graybow. She's a PhD. She received her doctorate in clinical psychology from Duquesne in 98 psychologist in California in 2001. She's been in private practice since 2003. And she's got a new book out called The Yoga of Food. And it invites us to explore what she calls contemplation prompts and meditations that'll really plug us into a deeper appreciation of our body's health and vitality. And she shares lessons and stories that she's cultivated from years of clinical practice. She gives us a roadmap toward a healthier approach to nutrition and the human spirit. So if you want to make food a partner rather than a problem or a pariah in your life, you want to listen for the next hour. Melissa, I'm so glad that you got a chance to join us tonight.
Thank you so much, Corby. That was a wonderful introduction.
You're more than welcome. Now, everybody wants to know, so how did you deal with this? How did you get into this? Why is this book your book? So give us a little backstory here.
Sure. So I became a psychologist in my early 20s, or that's when I entered the field. And the backdrop, so the foreground was school and getting my PhD and all the work that goes along with that. But in the background, I've always had this very uncomfortable relationship with my body and with food. So, and when I say an uncomfortable relationship, I struggled with what you would call an eating disorder. But in some ways, I call it a subclinical eating disorder in the sense I didn't really fit criteria for a full-blown one. But it was always just in the background of just, you know, what do I weigh? What should I eat? When should I eat it? How much, you know, just all of that chatter. And so in my mid-30s, I found yoga. And yoga has been so helpful for me in both understanding my relationship with my body, but also healing it and healing my relationship with food. And then obviously, and all this time, I'm also practicing psychology. And so what I'm hearing from my clients, and mostly women, but men as well, but it is mostly women, because I think we have a different relationship with our bodies than men, is just this backdrop of discomfort. So most people don't come to see me because of their weight. And often, just years into therapy, it'll come up, or I'm always thinking about it. Or so I'm fascinated with our relationship with our body and with what that yoga then has to teach us about that.
So now, people think about yoga and, you know, they think of this size 2 pretzel who subsists on, celery sticks and tofu. And you're going to say that if that's yoga, that's not me.
Exactly.
So I think men help me here.
Right. Well, let me just tell you, first of all, the book is working with the philosophy of yoga first, also the practice of yoga. But a lot of people who don't know about yoga, who don't know much about it, yoga began as a philosophy. And the physical practice actually came much, much later and has just in some ways been almost arbitrarily linked to the philosophy. They go well together, but they didn't necessarily come together. So the philosophy of yoga is a different perspective of the mind and the body. So yoga means to yoke. And essentially what that means is relationship. Yoga is about relationship. And so if you want to think about what the yoga of food means, it means what is our relationship to food, to our breath, to our body, to our world, to our community, to one another. Yoga is about relationship. So if I could just go on a little bit more, yoga philosophy does not just look at one body. There are five bodies. And in my book, I talk about the first three bodies, which are the physical body, the energetic body, and the mental body. And the physical body, we go on the inside. I'm not talking about what you look like, how much you weigh, what your measurements are. I'm talking about under the skin, the tissue, the organs, the cacophony of cells that are working together in this magical way. So you're looking at both food and body in a very physical way, but in terms of the quality and the substance. The energy body
I always do analogy. So it sounds like you're looking at the body as an entire orchestra on a physical level, not just the way we look at the shape and the poundage and say that's the body.
Exactly. And I love the word orchestra. Exactly. And I think in our culture, because we're so hypnotized by the external body, which is the most superficial kind of ridiculous fixation, right? What we look like. Mm-hmm. We're so hypnotized by that, that we forget that we are magical beings. I mean, yes. The system, I mean, if you think about what your body is doing every single day, in spite of our own behavior, right? Because many times we're not helping ourselves. And so if you begin to think about that and you drink the diet soda and you're putting a chemical inside of this beautiful creation that you are, why would you do that? I mean, none of us would do that if we were really aware. So it's beginning to bring this awareness and a compassion. And so it's not in a self-punitive way of, oh, I'm such a jerk, I'm drinking this bad thing for me, but, oh, what am I doing to myself? Why would I do this? So bringing awareness. The energetic body is what the vitality, the breath, the whatever it is that makes us alive. What is that, right?
Prana.
Yes, chi. And so energy is vital. And many of us have a relationship to food that is distorted because we have a very bad relationship with our own energy system. So using breath, we begin to self-regulate with breath. And many people's breath is so constricted and shut down that they reach for the soda or the sugar to give themselves energy because they aren't energizing themselves at a cellular level. And they have a hard time self-regulating using breath and using movement. So the second section of my book is about how do you begin to use the magic keys of breath and movement to turn on the energy body, to access the energy body.
I think that's so important because how many people sit at desks and don't move? And with the amount of stress that we are put in, not just with food and diet, but finances, Ebola, politics,
exactly.
The world. It's as if we hold our breaths waiting for the next blow to come.
Exactly.
We're not living.
I just took a deep breath. Thank you for reminding me. Yes. And the mind does not know the difference, or the body does not know the difference between a charging tiger and Ebola that is across the continent, or the taxes that are due, or the kids that are screaming and I'm exhausted and I've got to go, pick them up and get them here and there. And so that level of stress affects us at a very deep level. And so many of us unconsciously or consciously use food in a way to get us through the day. So, yeah. And so, and one of the vignettes actually that I have in the book is, you know, you're at your desk, it's 3 o'clock, you're exhausted, you're stressed, you had a bad day at work, you got to go get the kids. Okay. You just need a pick me up. You know, and so then you get a snack, and it's like, we do that without knowing we're doing it. And so yoga is a way to bring awareness to those patterns, and awareness is the first step toward change. Awareness with compassion.
When you do that snack thing, for a lot of us, it's been, you know, subliminally told food takes care of you. Mm-hmm. And when you are taking care of the boss and the kids and the family and the house and that is the only way you know of to do anything kind for yourself, how can you switch that? Literally, circuit breaker.
Right. Well, I think what you do is, what happens in life is, I think some, at some point we are, our suffering begins to outweigh the habit. And so you're in a habit of thinking about food in a certain way. So when you start to see that, you then take the risk of, you know what, I'm going to try something new. So I just listened to this podcast about yoga and breathing. I am not going to eat the pretzels. I'm going to get on the floor and I'm going to do some deep breaths, and I'm going to do a lion's roar. I mean, you know what that is? It's where you go, and you just, you know, release the stress, and you do that. And then you feel a little bit better and you say, you know what? I think I'm going to get a glass of water and I feel better. Wow. That actually worked. So you open.
It takes a little time though. To make that work. You shouldn't expect it to be perfect the first time.
Right. And it does take time. And I think, you know, we're a part of our problem in this society is because we're so fixated on the external and we're into quick fixes. I mean, we all want a quick fix. I think many of us are under the impression that that change should come very easily and be in a pill. So that's, you know, that's deep programming in our culture. And this does take time. You're right. And it takes courage.
How can you stop yourself from saying, oh God, look at that. How can I wear that to work today? I'm so fat. And it doesn't matter if you're 5 pounds, 50 pounds, or 200 pounds overweight. You always use the same words. How do you get rid of that trip trigger?
You begin to turn down the volume on it. And so when you do it, you say, okay, I'm doing it again, and I'm not going to go there. And so in some ways, it takes a self-discipline. And I use that word discipline, disciple. It's self-love, that you're not going to feed that voice anymore. In many yoga classes, you'll hear this story. I've got these two dogs in my backyard. One's really sweet and loving, and one's a real, you know, animal, real aggressive. And you ask, well, which one barks more? The one I feed more. So you are starting to work with not feeding that angry, critical part of you that, you know, maybe you've been feeding for a lifetime, but you start to put her on a diet. I'm not going to go there. And so it's, you know, and at first it can feel awkward or forced, but that voice is going to be there. It's going to take time and feeding something else.
All right. One of the words that you use in the book is samskaras. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because that's not something most people will be familiar with.
Right. No, I'd love to. So samskaras is the yogic word for habits. We are what we repeatedly do. So the reason it's different is, I think it's a much deeper kind of explanation of it. So habit has effects on the physical, the energetic, and the mental. So one of the examples I use is myself when I had a binge eating problem. And the habit was so ingrained in my body and in my energy system that I literally would feel like I couldn't stop it. And I wanted to desperately. I wanted to stop. And when I would binge, it was like I was compelled from something outside of me. And so the physical level is neurons that fire together, wire together. So when you're in a habit, your body acclimates and molds itself around that habit. The energy part is the emotions and that sense I had of being compelled. And then the mental part is that the ways we begin to think about ourselves form our identity. So do you see how our behaviors form who we are, both physically, energetically, and mentally? And the beauty of being human is we always have the possibility of change by doing new things. But that takes tremendous courage. And I shouldn't say but. And it takes tremendous courage. So I talk about a time where I was on the way to a binge and I kind of broke out of it. And it was literally like breaking out of a demonic hole and just bursting free of it. And I felt so empowered afterward. And it's not like I never binged again. I did after that, but it was a very empowering moment. And
you shift your consciousness. You really feel it.
Yeah. And I didn't even shift my consciousness beforehand. I just broke out. I think I ran outside. It was fall in Vermont. It was nice, but I just pulled myself outside and then my consciousness changed. You see that? So I didn't shift my consciousness first, but I pulled out of it. And then I also make the point that what gave me the strength to do that is I'd already made a lot of changes beforehand. You know, I'd been in therapy. I'd done a lot of personal work. So I think many people are afraid to break out of an addiction or a samskara because they don't know what's on the other side. So it's like this invisible courage.
They really have to give, it is compassion to give yourself the courage to do it and to keep doing it. And if you don't get it right once, don't say it doesn't work, because that's one of the things when you look at yoga, you can stretch so far the first time and then farther, and then you get rid of the blocks and then you start going right down to the floor. And no good teacher is going to say, you've never done this before. Here, get down here, downward dog. I want you to do that exactly like everybody who's been here forever.
Exactly.
So the compassion is so important. So important.
It's so important, and the patience with it. And I think the beautiful thing about yoga, too, is that most people, if they go to an appropriate class for their level, you feel so good afterward, even if you didn't touch your toes, that there's essentially your body's parasympathetic nervous system kicks in, you relax. And that's what keeps people coming back, not how good they are at it, but how good they feel. And that has
yoga makes you stop. It makes you stop and be.
It does.
What is it like when people learn to stop and just be with food?
Yeah.
When can
and
they
their
get there?
Body, right?
Mm-hmm.
And be with a hungry body.
Oh, that scares people. Oh my God, I'm hungry. What's going to happen? So do you deal with that? You're just sitting with a hungry body? Is that one of the exercises?
No, but I like it. It should be. Well, you know what I've come to realize in my own life is I do have a stress response to being hungry. So when I'm making dinner in the evenings, I didn't used to be aware of this, but I feel my throat, you know, I'm tight, I'm hungry, and I'm pushing. And it's a really unhealthy physical state to sit down in. So one of the things I encourage clients to do, and I'm working on the practice, I don't do it perfectly, is doing a 5-minute breath meditation before eating, you know, to sort of calm that frantic hunger down. You know, you're not going to be starved. There is enough food. It's okay to be hungry. Because sometimes
it's vital. Remember, one of the tricks they always told us was put your fork down between bites. Now, that's a little precious, but at the same time, it did get you to stop focusing on the next bite and be with the bite you had.
Exactly. And that's very consonant with yoga, of not being so locked into your head that you're always rushing, rushing, rushing. So
how do you bring these three bodies together, the physical, the energy, and the mental body, to get them all cohesive, coherent, and cooperating?
You pay attention one step at a time, right? So I think sometimes, you know, starting at the level of the physical can be very helpful because it's concrete and tangible. So in the book goes through exercises of starting to really look at the quality of food that you're bringing in. So I talk about the karma of food, action and reaction, beginning to look at, you know, this food actually has information in it. And is this information that I want to bring into my body? And so beginning to work with the tangible, what I'm bringing into my body, what I'm doing on a daily basis, then moves you into, okay, maybe it's time now to move into the energy body, working with relaxation and breath, working with my emotions. So one of the things I talk about is impulse, learning to manage impulse and hunger. Like I was mentioning my own experience of hunger. How do you manage that? And just becoming aware of it. So my awareness of my tension when I'm hungry is a first step toward, okay, now how can I soften that? And then the level of the mind is where meditation comes in, of quieting.
How do you turn off, you know, you're watching Castle, we're Castle fans here, and all of a sudden Lobster Fest comes on and you see, I mean, it's food porn.
It is, isn't it?
Do you turn off the Pavlovian reaction?
I don't know if you can, right? It's automatic. It's instinctive. I think you're
how
just
do you get
aware.
Okay
maybe I don't want to be watching that right now, or knowing the impact that it's going to have on you and having a plan about how not to act out on it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Corby, one thing we haven't gotten into, and I talk a little bit about nutrition, but I think a lot of us are eating diets such that we're very, very vulnerable to cravings and to overeating because our diets are pretty impaired in our culture, I believe. And so a lot of us are nutritionally deficient, very, very tired, not feeling so well. And so we're addicted to this hyper palatable food. And so when we're, you know, I'm a Food Network fan, but when you're watching that, you know, it can really get the juices flowing if you're already in and I don't know the science too much on this, but, you know, they've talked about addiction and dopamine responses, which is a neurochemical in the brain that's linked to addictive behaviors or addictive cycles, and that happens for people around food. So that's the other piece, that if you realize that you're somebody who's really triggered by that, you probably don't watch it, or you really look at your diet and there are things that you can do. And I'm not talking about self-deprivation, but shifts that you can make that make you feel better so that you're not so susceptible to that craving.
Mm-hmm. Absolute awareness. If you're just joining us tonight on Fire Through Spirit, I am delighted to be talking with author Melissa Graybell, who has written The Yoga of Food, Wellness from the Inside Out, Healing the Relationship with Food and Your Body. And we have been going all over the map. We're going to continue after the break. Melissa, very quickly, where can people find the book and where can people find you?
They can find the book on Amazon or in Whole Foods, and they can find me on my website is witnesstherapy.com.
And you're based out of California, so do you work with people at distance, or do people have to go to the West Coast to find you?
You know, I'm open to working with people at distance, but actually have to be a California resident due to my license.
Got it.
Yeah.
I know. It's what the lawyers always tell us to do. So anyway, if you're not in California, this is your opportunity to really listen to Melissa, get it from the horse's mouth, really learn about how you can adjust your thinking around food, your thinking around your own body. That's what we're working on in Fire Through Spirit tonight, and I hope you keep with us for the next half hour. We'll see you after the break.
To Empower Radio. For a complete archive of Fire Through Spirit, visit empowerradio.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast through iTunes and Stitcher Radio. More Fire Through Spirit with Corby Midline next on Empower Radio.
I'm home and I love it. I'm home where I belong. I'm home, and I love it. I'm home, where I belong.
It's always nice to come home, but these days, many Americans are at risk of foreclosure and losing their homes. Fortunately, help is available. Making Home Affordable is a free program from the U.S. government that has already helped over 1 million struggling homeowners, and we want to help you.
I'm home. And I love it, I'm home.
Find out now what your options are. Go to makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE. The sooner you act, the better chance we can help you.
I'm home, where I belong.
Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Danger at the Old Well.
Last one to the old well's a rotten egg. Ha-ha, I win. Whoa! Ah! Sassy! Johnny fell down the well.
I'm wet.
What, Sassy? You know where Mr. Gunderson keeps his rope? Go get it, girl. What? You'd rather use this time to set people straight about shelter pet adoption?
I'm cold.
People shouldn't be afraid to adopt from a shelter? Because shelter pets are screened for sound, health, and temperament?
I'm wet and cold!
Sassy, what about Johnny? What? Let Johnny sit in the well until he learns to be more self-reliant? Sassy!
What'd he say?
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
Have you ever lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it?
Hi there, I'm Andrew Hoffman. I went on this website called InventNow.org. Then I decided to make an invention of my own. It's called the Lost Cat Magnet Invention. So you can get your cat back after you lost it. Just turn it on, and lost cats stick to it. That's a good cat. If your cat was hiding up in a tree, it won't be up a tree anymore. It will be stuck to the Lost Cat Magnet. And sometimes they fly toward you in the air. Just listen to one satisfied cat. See? That's proof. You should go to the InventNow.org website too. But just remember one thing. Don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at InventNow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
This is Empower Radio.
EmpowerRadio.com.
Now, back to Fire Through Spirit with Corby Midline.
Welcome back to a fascinating discussion. My guest tonight is Melissa Graybaugh, and we're talking about the yoga of food wellness from the inside out. One of the things that I saw in here, and boy, is it something that I understand, is what you resist persists. Could you tell us a little about that? And if you have anybody who is an illustration for that, I'm sure we'd love to hear it, because I love the abstract ideas. But when we hear, yeah, so-and-so went through this, boy, do we identify.
Right.
So.
Right. Well, so, you know, resistance, our friend Freud, Sigmund Freud, developed psychoanalysis around this whole idea of resistance. I think he was really the first person who put a name to it. And he noted that people were so attached to their symptoms, right? To their misery. And that's psychoanalysis, where you go in 5 days a week and you don't look at the analyst and you're laying on the couch, was developed as a way to circumvent that. So what happens, and this is from a yogic perspective, is that the mind becomes very highly identified with our suffering. It's bizarre. And people mm-hmm. get, you know, the samskara, people's identity begin to get built around the pain or the weight or the I'm a fat person or I have no willpower. That's who I am. And so we get identified with that. And so even though we may try to, you know, wrangle ourselves into shape by going on a diet, the resistance to sort of looking at that belief then comes through. What we resist persists. So the resistance to looking and owning that self-belief then creates an attachment to it and a persistence of it. So it meets you on the other side. So the example I use in the book is an anorexic woman who, you know, bless her soul, she had a seizure caused by electrolyte imbalance and really was scared straight for a number of years. And then various stressors happened and she relapsed into the anorexia. And so the short memory there, but I think what had happened is that those issues hadn't been fully worked through in terms of that identification with it and that need for the anorexia. And so it came
That's
up
a good
again.
Point.
Yeah. So in any change process, if you force yourself into something with a self-corrective attitude, whatever the symptom was expressing will come back in another form. And so we have to come with an attitude of self-acceptance and self-compassion and kind of look at our own craziness or our own fallibility and our own issues with care. And I think most of us need help to do that because, you know, most people are just so hard on themselves.
Just why is that self-love so difficult, though?
Such a
you would
question.
Think we live with us. Who else could we love but us?
Well, we learn to relate to ourselves as we were related to. And although for many of us, hopefully, our parents loved us, they loved us very imperfectly and often in ways that were damaging. And we've internalized that. So that's sort of getting into the deep conditioning at looking at some of the things you learned about yourself. So, for example, you know, big boys don't cry or little girls don't get dirty. You know, that maybe came from a loving parent who was passing on her own conditioning. But what the child can hear or feel is I'm not lovable unless I'm clean or unless I'm strong. And that mm-hmm. creates a dissonance within the self.
That's a whole reparenting thing, which is a whole nother show.
Exactly.
You want to stick with the food.
Exactly.
So,
well, but I mean, you can look at it that you live that through food. So for many, mm-hmm. I'm going to stay with women, they live with this ambivalent relationship that I want to love myself and nurture myself, but I'm only good if I'm thin. So I'm in this real difficult, stressful situation. And so how do I begin to honor my appetite and kind of open to that without that same self-punitive, punishing kind of orientation?
We got the double message. My grandmother was famous. Eat one more bite than you want, then you've had enough. How do we learn what hunger is? How do we learn what enough is?
I know.
It's crazy.
Those are deep, deep questions. But you know what's interesting, Corby, if you think about it? The first time in history, right, where we have more than enough food and we're suffering because we have too much food. It's rather ironic. I mean, for most of human history, like, wasn't life around having enough and making sure we didn't starve? And now,
yes.
Get us. I mean, it's just It's very interesting. Now we're struggling with how much is enough and what should I be putting in myself. I mean, I think people are just so confused, and I speak as one of them in terms of what should we even be eating, right? It's
part of it is all of the chemicals that they're putting in. They ramp up our appetite. So unless we have a very good sense, a centered sense of when is enough, what is good for us.
Exactly.
We're wandering in the forest.
And that takes time to develop. And I think, again, getting back to yoga and sort of commercialized yoga, you can look at the gal in the Lululemon pants and think, well, she knows what she's doing. I should be doing what she's doing. Or she knows she has some magic secret that I don't have. And I think most of us have to sort of bushwhack through the forest, you know, in terms of using information out there. But the greatest source of information is our own body. But most of us are not listening. And that comes from, you know, with this
taught not to.
Yeah. And this awareness practice, and it is a practice, is learning to go inside and listen and feel and breathe. And I promise anyone who's listening, who struggles, over time, you get familiar and you get to know yourself from the inside. And it really anchors you and creates tremendous self-confidence. Not based on achievement, but based on self-awareness and self-acceptance that's genuine. So it's really, it's a beautiful, beautiful practice. It's so rich with the rewards. And your relationship to food is just going to be one expression of that. You know, you don't want to hurt yourself anymore.
But there's a chapter, I love the title, Too Clever for Your Own Good.
Yeah.
Nonamaya Kosa. I talked about, I looked at that and I said, yeah, how many of us are like that?
Exactly.
Talk to me about that chapter. Well, I love that.
The Too Clever for Your Own Good, that's our everyday mind that's always thinking and always strategizing and planning. And so there's good use for that mind. It gets us to work on time and all that. Most of us have a very hard time turning it off. And that's the part of the mind, I think, that looks in the mirror and says, you're so fat. What's wrong with you? You need to go on a diet. And that mind gets on the computer and Googles the best diet. So that mind is clever and it's helpful, but it's not aligned with your greater good or your spiritual good or it's not aware of the fact that life is impermanent and what really matters. So learning how to use that mind for what it's worth to get you to work on time and pay your taxes, but then allying more with your buddhi, which is the yogic word for your wiser mind, for insight, for awareness. So my website is called Witness Therapy. The witness is the yogic term for the part of you that sees yourself, the part of you that says, you know, Melissa, you're like really tense when you're cooking dinner and then you sit down and eat. Maybe that's not in your best interest. Whereas my clever mind says, well, that's because I've got things to do and I'm in a hurry. Get out of my way.
You know, there's a term in courtrooms called the expert witness, the one that knows everything about a certain subject. And we are expert witnesses on ourselves. What we have to do is we have to see what's we've been witnessing that's really, if you will, a falsehood. It's not really who we are and what truth is. So then you've got a chapter called Getting Closer to Your Wisdom Body. How do you do that?
Through the ongoing practice of this awareness. And through meditation, what you do is you learn how to turn down the volume on that more chattery mind and you move into the wisdom mind. And, you know, it's kind of hard to explain. It's kind of like describing the color blue to someone who can't see. It's you kind of know it when you're there. But, you know, one way I like to think about it, and I think this is kind of tangible, a very well-known psychiatrist named Daniel Siegel talks about the brain. He says, you know, when we talk about the brain, we just think of the head. And he says that's where the neurons are most dense and all those connections are most dense. But the brain extends, those neurons connect through your entire body. And so the wisdom body is really learning to feel into your whole body. And that brings an awareness and a feel. And, you know, in some ways I can make it tangible. When I get there, I just feel a warmth through my whole body. And I feel a synchronicity in my breath. And I feel an awareness. And, you know, I'm not like levitating above the couch or anything, but it's just a sense of at-homeness in my skin. And so that is touching on the wisdom body. Now, I make it clear in my book, I'm not talking about esoteric levels of yoga here. My book is very much about the personal self, and the goal of real yoga, of the philosophy of yoga, is to really transcend the self and to reach nirvana, or to kind of leave identification with the ego. And I'm not there at all in my writing. I mean, I'm not using yoga in that way. I'm using it more to kind of work on strengthening the individual self.
I don't think most people that go for yoga these days really are interested in nirvana and levitating. They just want to get calmer. And so exactly. that's how I see your book. It's getting calmer about food. If yeah. you're calm, you can work
and
it better.
Getting,
if
you getting can, smarter about it. And I don't mean that, you know, in a punitive or pejorative way, but just what makes me feel better? What doesn't, you know, how do I feel after, you know, snarfing down 4 pieces of pizza and 2 beers? Not so great. Is this in my best interest? You know, part of the yoga or the is learning to act on your own behalf. I love that. You know, so many of us do not act on our own behalf. I guess the word self-sabotage comes up. You know, that's a real frequent complaint from a lot of my clients. Why do I self-sabotage? Why do I get in the way of what I most want? You know, and so how do we get out of our own way and start acting on our own behalf with food, among other things? You know,
you have to become conscious.
Janine Roth, have you heard of her? She's an expert in eating
I adore Janine Roth.
Yes. Yeah, so
when you open the refrigerator, pull up a chair.
Yes. So her point in Women, Food, and God, and it's kind of similar, is how we relate to food is how we relate to everything. It's a big metaphor. And so the yoga food is just, you know, a different take on it, but beginning to relate to your body with more acceptance and loving kindness as a doorway into relating to food from that place. And when you're in that place, you don't want to hurt yourself with food, even if it tastes good. You know, it's just not worth it. And that's
when you work with an autistic child. They're doing the isms because that makes them feel good, but it's not useful. It's not really nourishing them. In a sense, stuffing your face with, you know, a 2-pound bag of Doritos is an ism.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're turned off to
yes.
where you are.
Yes. It's hurtful. You know, one of my clients in the book, her name is Janice in the book, and she talks about how, you know, she had a really, really bad binge eating disorder. And she says, you know, I eat all this fast food, but I only give my dog little bites because I know it's not good for him. That was a real awakening for her of like, wow, why do I do that to myself when I don't want to do that to my dog, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's brilliant. If you were going to give people tonight one exercise to do, just a tiny little step forward into this, what would you do? What can people take from this tonight?
I'd have them sit and maybe just for 5 minutes, take their mind into the inside of their body, sort of feeling breath and maybe using hands, putting hands on your rib cage, your belly, your thighs, your buttocks, and just feeling into that flesh and how the breath moves your flesh, and taking a moment to really consider what an amazing experience it is to be embodied. Like, I believe that we're very, I believe it's rare and that we're very lucky to have the chance of having a body. Like, I think about when my daughter was a baby or a toddler, and she was just running around, and I kind of, if there was a bubble above her head, it would say, look at these five great fingers I have on this hand, and look, I can jump, and look, I've got this body, and it's awesome. Because I think it's a really special experience to be in a body, and it's hard and it's painful at times, but it's also wonderful at times, you know? And so just really reflecting, I guess, on the obvious, what's right under your skin is the amazingness of having this opportunity. It is an opportunity.
People don't realize, I have a kind of niece by adoption, and her name is Ellery, and she is turned up to 11. If you remember this Spinal Tap thing, her entire life, but it doesn't mean she's bouncing off the walls. It means she is intently herself. She has no self-consciousness. She absolutely is into everything that she's doing. She's into her food. Her parents raise her basically on a paleo primal style. And the food is put in front of her, and she looks at it, and she tastes it, and she plays with it a little bit. And, you know, and her father never talks to her in baby talk. Her father says, yes, that's a piece of Gruyere cheese. Do we like Gruyere cheese? This child is going to have such a good self-sense and a brilliant sense about food, because the food is not ignored.
Yeah.
And in a sense, it is demystified. It's good food.
Yes. I love it. That's
so
wonderful.
The kid will be a yogi, you know, a food yogi, very clearly.
I think she already is.
If only we could do that. Now, so here we are. We understand we need to breathe. We understand that we've got our physical body, our energy body, and our mental body, and we're ready to put it together. We're ready to drop our habits. We're ready to be in the present moment. When do we know we've made that amazing shift?
Well, you know, Corby, with all change processes, it comes and it goes. So you have moments where you feel it, like I described that sense of connection I have with myself, and then you lose it, and then you feel it again, and then you lose it. And over time, you feel it more than you lose it. You know, it's like learning to play the piano. You practice every day. You learn a song, you learn another song, you mess up, you keep going, you know? And then over time, you don't even care if you've gotten it, because you just do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is going to be one that most people have to deal with. Fine, you're doing the yoga of food. Your husband is doing the couch potato of food. Your kids are doing the I only eat pizza of food.
Yeah.
How do you maintain your yoga when everybody else is forget it?
It's huge. What you say is just huge. I think so many of us are a lot of my clients say that, well, the kids eat this. I can't. Part of yoga, when this is maybe a little bit more about psychology, is learning to self-validate. So it may be right for my husband to do the couch potato of food or couch potato of yoga. This is right for me, and it isn't hurting anyone, and I can still fix my child some pizza as long as they have a big salad with it, and I'm going to have the salad and the salmon or whatever. That you self-validate. You don't, it's learning to pull yourself out of the them or the they, and be okay being who you are. And you know what your needs are, you know, and they may be different than a 10-year-old boy who's playing soccer. That's okay.
And the key is not to have to defend yourself to your family. If you're defending something, a kid's not going to have an interest. But if you say, yeah, well, your pizza is good, I'm really loving this salad, instead of, well, mommy's not supposed to eat pizza, honey.
Exactly. Yeah, because then you're poisoning. Then you're coming from a deprivation model, and that's no good. But yeah, if you're enjoying it and just owning your choice, but then allowing others to make their choices. And with kids especially, you know, you just have to be careful.
You do. They're sponges.
Overbearing. Yeah, they are. And being overbearing, I mean, what we resist persists. If you're like too controlling with a kid, you're in for it.
And it's reverse psychology. If you say, well, mommy's not allowed to have the pizza, the kid will subliminally think, well, maybe someday I'm not going to be allowed to have pizza. I'd better eat it now. And
you're
then
right.
That sets up everything.
You're right. That's one of the things I tell my daughter. She says, mommy, am I going to be like you someday and not be able to eat this stuff? I said, you know what? No, because you have much better sense than I did at your age. Because she doesn't eat seven pieces of pizza. She eats one or one and a half and then gets full. So her system,
she understands.
She's still connected to her body, thankfully.
You know, that's the whole thing. Whereas when I was 11 in 1966 and the first year Weight Watchers came out, my mother marched me in, said, you're fat. You're going to do this. Mm. You take an 11-year-old now and it's the farthest thing from what you would do.
You know, Corbish, you might as well have taken I don't mean this to be a violent metaphor, but a knife and cut your mind from your body or dissociated your mind from your body and said, your body is bad and we are going to fix it. And so you were no longer whole.
And we have had to come back from that. If you can prevent that separation for your kids, maybe even teach it to your husband, you never know. They could listen. It will turn around the obesity in this country. It will turn around the obsessions in this country. It will free us up to look at so many other things that are more important, more substantive, more supportive.
Thank you for saying
people
that.
To the left and the right of us.
Yeah, because it's kind of like, I want to be thin and healthy for what? It's not an end in and of itself. It's so that so our energy is freed up, just like you said, to be of service in the world. Because the world is in a desperate place.
It is. You can have this gorgeous train, best paint job, running on the best fuel, and it's sitting in the yard going, I have such a cool train. Train needs to go somewhere.
Yeah,
we're all trains sitting in the yard. We don't know.
Yeah.
So this has been so much fun and you have let me go all over the mat, Melissa, and you've been so gracious about it. Thank you so much. The book is The Yoga of Food, Wellness from the Inside Out. It's such a smart book. It's such a compassionate book. It's a book that takes a look at all the things that we do to ourselves and brings it into what I would call the gentle discipline of yoga. There's karma yoga. There's hatha yoga. This is fridge yoga. And I know that it can make an enormous difference for every one of you that's listening and scribbling notes and checking in sync, but they didn't talk about calories and they didn't talk about pasture raised versus grain fed. No, that's not the point. You guys can do that. This is so you will relax about the stuff on your plate. You will look at it and you will say, do I really want that? Does my body really want that? Or am I eating it because someone else told me I should or told me I shouldn't eat what the other things are? It's a beautiful, brilliant book and it's long past time for it to have been written. Melissa, my hat's off to you on this one.
Well, Corby, thank you so much. And it has been a great pleasure.
Tell people again where they're going to find the book and where they're going to find you, if you please.
Yes, the book is on Amazon or you can find it at Whole Foods. And you can find me at witnesstherapy.com or you can just Google me. I should come up.
If this has been a useful hour to you, my dear listeners, then do me a gift tonight. Just sit with your body. You don't have to stare into your own eyes and mirror. You don't have to do anything but just be with it. Remember that you chose to come down here. You're in Earth School. This is one of the semesters. And this is the vehicle that you're doing your learning with. No matter what it looks like, no matter whether it's aging, no matter whether it's a size 2 or a 12 or a 22, it's yours, baby. It is how you're going to make a difference in the world. It takes you from point A to point B. And just like the car that you love and you name and you wash every week and you wax, your body deserves the same amount of love and care and delight. Because if you're listening to this show, I know you're a light worker like the rest of us, and we all have work to do in the world. So you need to keep that body well. You need to keep it in balance. And that means keep your mind about it in balance too. So I'm off my soapbox for tonight. If you're looking for me, you can always find me at Facebook, Fire Through Spirit. My website, firethroughspirit.com. You can find me on Twitter under Corby Mitlide. And if you absolutely have to get in touch with me right away, you can always call 877-321-CORBY. That's 877-321-2672. Have a wonderful week. Have a delicious week. And come back and see us next Thursday night. Have a good one.